Okay, now we come to the last part of the book. Still a lot to go, as you can see. You realize there's a Romans 3, and you may not have noticed there are three parts in the book. Two we have read, and so Joyce is in his schema, in his plan, that you probably have somewhere, and we're sure we showed it. You have a first part of three chapters that belong to Stephen Dedalus. Then we have 12 chapters just finished, where there's mainly Bloom. And now we have the three last, so they're symmetrical, 3, 12, 3, 18 chapters in all. But it's also non-symmetrical, because as you can see, the first three chapters together are shorter than any of the three chapters that are still coming. What I want to emphasize is there is both symmetry and the opposite, that kind of thing. But it is structured, the book, like a triptych, where you have a big central altarpiece flanked by two things. So it's something quite common. And there is a sort of a structure, but it's a symmetric. And you see we're going back to Bloom again. And again, a narrative, a continuous narrative, which we haven't had for a long time. They're usually long paragraphs, and we do them one by one. So we start them.
Come here, little boy, in all of the green, well, soft and high, the blood of the night, I'm in the eyes, the red is clear, through eyes of star, I believe, arise with the stars, for the stars. Well, on the Christmas lit, where the day was all, I would add, the fish comes from the river's fall, the sword of the serenade. Cry the love of happy song, fly the new from song to song, but all the river flowed along,
the preparatory to anything else, Mr. Bloom brushed off the greater bulk of the shavings and handed Stephen the hat and ashplant, and bucked him up generally in orthodox Samaritan fashion, which he very badly needed. His, Stephen's, mind was not exactly what you would call wandering, but a bit unsteady, and on his expressed desire for some beverage to drink, Mr. Bloom, in view of the hour it was, and there being no pumps of Vartry water available for their ablutions, let alone drinking purposes, hit upon an expedient by suggesting, off the reel, the propriety of the cabman's shelter, as it was called, hardly a stone's throw away near Butt Bridge, where they might hit upon some drinkables in the shape of milk and soda or a mineral. But how to get there was the rub. For the nonce, he was rather nonplussed, but inasmuch as the duty plainly devolved upon him to take some measures on the subject, he pondered suitable ways and means, during which Stephen repeatedly yawned. So far as he could see, he was rather pale in the face, so that it occurred to him as highly advisable to get a conveyance of some description, which would answer in their then condition, both of them being ED, Ed, particularly Stephen, always assuming that there was such a thing to be found. Accordingly, after a few such preliminaries, as, in spite of his having forgotten to take up his rather soap-suddy handkerchief after it had done yeoman service in the shaving line, brushing, they both walked together along Beaver Street, or more properly, Lane, as far as the farrier's and the distinctly fetid atmosphere of the livery stables at the corner of Montgomery Street, where they made tracks to the left, from thence debouching into Amiens Street, round by the corner of Dan Bergen's. But, as he confidently anticipated, there was not a sign of a Yehu plying for hire anywhere to be seen, except a four-wheeler, probably engaged by some fellows inside on the spree, outside the North Star Hotel, and there was no symptom of its budging a quarter of an inch when Mr. Bloom, who was anything but a professional whistler, endeavoured to hail it by emitting a kind of a whistle, holding his arms arched over his head twice.
Now, this is quite easy to follow. It is a normal kind of prose as you get in a novel. Elaborate sentences sometimes, just to tune you up. Imagine you are a teacher, students handing papers. You're an editor that have to look at or something like that. You might say sometimes it could be said a bit easier and a bit more directly. That's all I want to say now. Preparatory to anything else. That looks like a flourish to say first, preparatory to anything else. Mr. Bloom, it's again Mr., brushed off the greater bulk of the shavings and handed Stephen the hat and the ash plant, and bucked him up generally in orthodox Samaritan fashion. You know, the good Samaritan who took care of some who was knocked down, which he very badly needed. Here's Stephen's hand. Well, not exactly what you would call wandering. And you can see here also already and throughout a kind of uncertainty that I often have. So the way I put it is not quite what I wanted to say, and I'm aware of it. So you all don't quite hit, maybe not you, of course, but some of us. Not they're called wandering, but a bit unsteady. And on his expressed desire for some beverage to drink, Mr. Bloom, in view of the hour it was, and there being no pumps of watery water available, watery water, you may wonder what that is. Well, all the Dublin water comes from a place watery. So it is ordinary water, not something like Nishi or something like that. It's just for their ablutions, let alone drinking purposes, no water to drink or wash. Hit upon expedience by suggesting, off the wheel, the propriety of the cabin shelter. Always wonder the word propriety. Is this proper? Propriety. Now, if you have just come from the red light district, from the brothel area, propriety is a little bit odd. It may be what is meant is proximity. Or something like that, of the cabin shelter, as it was called. Hardly a stone throw away near Budbridge, where they might hit upon some drinkables in the shape of a milk and soda or a mineral. Of course, no more alcohol after that. But how to get there was the rub. The nonce, it was rather nonplussed, but inasmuch as the duty plainly devolved upon him to take some measures on the subject, he pondered suitable ways and means during which Stephen repeatedly yawned. So far, as you can see, he was rather pale in the face, so that it occurred to him as highly advisable to get a conveyance of some description which would answer in their then condition. Both of them being, ED, it means probably tired or exhausted, peculiar Stephen, always assuming that there was such a thing to be found. Accordingly, after a few such preliminaries as, in spite of his having forgotten to take up his rather service of the handkerchief after that yeoman service in the shaving line, you realize that leads back to the first chapter, where Stephen had his handkerchief taken away by Mulligan to shave. Bloom, of course, doesn't know that. So the perspective is generally Bloom's, but not always. They both walk together. You know, notice how important the word both is here. They both walk together. It's totally unnecessary. Along Beaver Street, or more properly Lane, the correction, as far as the farriers, and the distinctly fetid atmosphere of the livery stables at the corner of Montgomery Street. Again, we have the exact location, where they made tracks to the left from thence debouching into Enid Street, round the corner of Dan Burgin's. So these are the details of the place. And you could walk them all, trace them on the map. But as he confidently anticipated, there was not a sign of a Yahoo flying for hire. What is a Yahoo? A Yahoo is a cab driver, and it's taken from the Bible. There was a Yahoo, which is, and he driveth furiously. So that's a biblical echo, no longer familiar, of course. Flying for hire, anywhere to be seen, except a four-wheeler, probably engaged by some fellows inside on the street, outside the North Star Hotel. So again, we know where it is. There is a North Star Hotel. And there was no symptom of its budging a quarter of an inch when Mr. Bloom, who was anything but a professional whistler — how many professional whistlers do you know? — endeavoured to hail it by emitting a kind of a whistle, holding his arm arched over his head twice. So Bloom is not an expert and certainly no professional whistle. And you can see there are some awkwardnesses. And I must say that the chapter has had a kind of bad press. Many readers said, yeah, it's late in the day, they're all bored, and it's been boring, and so the prose is bored. And somebody even said, Joyce was bored when you wrote that. You see that its charm is just that it's never quite right. And we can go through it again just to emphasize this. Prepared anything, Mr. Bloom brushed the grey rough shavings and handed him the hat and bucked him up generally. I am brushed shavings, bucked him up. That might remind you of the first chapter, the first page, where Buck Mulligan is prepared to shave with a brush. That is not what the prose wants to say, but it's an echo that you would have in orthodox Samaritan fashion. Now, you know the story of the Orthodox Samaritan, the Bible. There was somebody who was marked, and all the Orthodox believing Jews mainly walked, but somebody from Samaria, which was despised. They were lesser people. He was had the courage to help the man. So the Samaritan was exactly not an Orthodox believer, but an outsider. And that's the point. So you see that this comparison is awkward, is wrong, it's lopsided, which he very badly needed. You often don't know who is he, but the next, his, Stephen's mind, was not exactly what you call wandering, but with unsteady. Well, it is not exactly what you call wandering. Why do you call it wandering? But as I say, you're not so sure of whether it's all right. But a bit unsteady. And on his expressed desire for some beverage to drink. What else could he do with the beverage? You realize that. Mr. Bloom, in view of the hour it was, and there be no pumps of water available for their ablutions. Ablutions? Have you abluted this morning? You're probably washed, but ablution is a special washing for a religious ceremony or something. You don't say, go to the bathroom and ablute your hands or something like that. So you see, it tries to be choice speaking and doesn't quite, and it is the shortcomings of the language that makes the chapter for many of us quite abusing, let alone drinking purposes. Hit upon an expedient. I never quite know whether that's good colloquial English, to hit upon an expedient off the reel. The proprietor came and shut, as it was called, hardly a stone's throw away near Buckwood. And you seem to hear throwaway doors, which of course has nothing to do with it, where they might hit upon. And again, you have the same hit upon, and it's not good style to use the same expression twice in a sentence, especially when it has a different meaning, because you better don't hit upon drinkables. my flash of it. In the shape of a milk or a soda. What shape has milk or a soda? But how to get there was the rub. You all know the rub. To be or not to be. Take your life. But the rub is whether when you're in the other world, it might be worse. So it's a Shakespeare quote used just for the how to get from here to there. For the nonce, it was rather nonplussed. But inasmuch as the duty plainly called of him to take some measures on the subject, he pondered suitable ways and means to which he repeatedly yawned. There is clearly an element of tiredness and boring in the chapter. So far, as you could see, he was rather pale in the face, so that it occurred to him highly advisable to get the conveyance of some description, something vague, which would answer their then condition. Both of them being Ed and tired, particularly Stephen, always supposing there was such a thing to be found. Accordingly, after a few such preliminaries, that should be like preparatory Paul, as in spite of his having forgotten to take his other soaps on the handkerchief, after he'd done yeoman service is another phrase, the yeomans were military people, and to do yeoman service is a phrase. And there are a lot of these idioms or cliches in the chapter. Rushing, they both walked together along Beaver Street, Mulberry Lane, as far as the farriers, and the distinctive head happens from Liver Stables at the corner of Montgomery Street, where they made tracks to the left. We can't follow this without the map. They bounced in Amos Street at the corner of Berkeley. But, the confidence of them, there was not the sign of a Yehu, meaning a car driver. Anyway, except the four-wheeler, probably engaged by some fellows out inside on the street, outside the Northern Hotel, and there was no symptom of its budging a quarter of an inch. It doesn't matter how much it does not budge. When Mr. Bloom, who was anything but a whistler, endeavoured to hail it by emitting a kind of whistle, holding his arm arched over his head twice. And you see, he's not an experienced whistler. So you see, what makes the chapter amusing for some of us, at least, and certainly on a further reading, perhaps not first, is that no sentence is quite right and you could do it differently. But I won't enlarge on that all the time now. So we tackle the second.
This was a quandary. But bringing common sense to bear on it, evidently there was nothing for it but put a good face on the matter and foot it, which they accordingly did. So, bevelling round by Mullet's and the Signal House, which they shortly reached, they proceeded perforce in the direction of Amiens Street Railway Terminus. Mr. Bloom being handicapped by the circumstance that one of the back buttons of his trousers had, to vary the time-honoured adage, gone the way of all buttons. Though entering thoroughly into the spirit of the thing, he heroically made light of the mischance. So, as neither of them were particularly pressed for time, as it happened, and the temperature refreshing, since it cleared up after the recent visitation of Jupiter Pluvius, they dammed it along, past by where the empty vehicle was waiting, without a fare or a jarvey. As it so happened, a Dublin United Tramways Company sandstrewer happening to be returning, the elder man recounted to his companion, apropos of the incident, his own truly miraculous escape of some little while back. They passed the main entrance of the Great Northern Railway Station, the starting point for Belfast, where, of course, all traffic was suspended at that late hour. And passing the back door of the morgue, a not very enticing locality, not to say gruesome to a degree, more especially at night, ultimately gained the Dock Tavern, and in due course turned into Store Street, famous for its C Division police station. Between this point and the high, at present unlit warehouses of Beresford Place, Stephen thought to think of Ibsen, associated with Baird's, the stonecutters in his mind, somehow in Talbot Place, first turning on the right, while the other, who was acting as his fidus Achates, inhaled with eternal satisfaction the smell of James Brooke's City Bakery, situated quite close to where they were, the very palatable odour, indeed, of our daily bread, of all commodities of the public, the primary and most indispensable. Bread, the staff of life, earn your bread. Oh, tell me, where is fancy bread? At Brooks the baker's, it is said.
No. This was a quandary, difficult situation, but bringing common sense to bear on it, evidently there was nothing for it but to put a good face on the matter and foot it. And you notice the closeness of put a good face on the matter and foot it. So the face and the foot are quite not together, which they accordingly did. So, leveling around by Mullet's and the signal house, which they shortly reached, they proceeded perforce in the direction of Amiens Street railway terminus, railway station, Mr. Bloom being handicapped by the circumstance that one of the back buttons of his trousers had, to vary the time on that adage, adage is a kind of quotation, had gone the way of all buttons. Echoing, of course, the way of all flesh. And we remember in Circe, or maybe not remember, that one button was on and went dip. So he is missing one button. So that had go the way of all buttons. And you see, this is full of quotations. Though entering thoroughly in the spirit of things, he heroically made light of the mischance. There's also elements of an adventure story. He heroically made light of the mischance, when there's no heroism needed at all. So, as neither of them were particularly pressed for time, you may notice that in this chapter, in this book of 1904, nobody was really pressed for time. As it happened, and the temps refreshing, since it cleared up, you remember there was a downpour, after the recent visitation of Jupiter Pluvius, Jupiter the rainmaker. That is, again, a classical allusion. Instead of rain, you say Jupiter Pluvius. They dandered along, passed by where the empty vehicle was waiting without a fare. Well, obviously, if it's empty, it doesn't have a fare. Just notice all these repetitions, these tautologies, that you say something that's already said. The MTV was waiting without a fare or a jarvey. As it so happened, the Dublin United Tramways Company Sandstrewer, is that, happening to be returning, the elder man recounted to his companion apropos of the incident, his own truly miraculous escape some little while back. And they passed, again you get the geography, they passed the main entrance of the Great Northern Railway Station, the starting port for Belfast. Of course, all traffic was suspended at that late hour. It doesn't really matter where the trains go that don't go right now. And passing the back door of the morgue, where the bodies, their bodies are, and not very enticing for Curry, not say gruesome to a degree, more especially at night, ultimately gained the Dock Tavern, and in due course turned into Store Street, famous for its C Division police station. Between this point and the high, at present unlit warehouse of Bellows Place, Stephen thought to think of Ibsen, associated with Bellows, a stonecutter in his mind, somehow in Talbot Place. And that is an echo of a portrait where Stephen walks to the university, and as he comes to this place, he always thinks of Ibsen. And I think we all have that at certain places, certain memories come. So Stephen, as we already heard in a portrait, thinks of Ibsen, literature, while the other, who was acting as his Fidus Achates. Fidus Achates, we already heard that before in the third chapter, is from the Aeneid, the Roman epic. Achates is the the man who escapes from Troy, and he is the faithful companion of Aeneas, who is ultimately going to build Rome. So Thetis or Carthage is again attacked. Inhaled with eternal satisfaction the smell of James City Bakery. So there's a bakery there. And typically, Stephen thinks of literature, and Bloom thinks of something to eat, food. The City Bakery, situated quite close to where they were, the very palatable odor indeed of our daily bread. And then he has an association to bread, like in Dear Monologue. Of all commodities of the public, primary and most indispensable. Then we have some associates, bread, stuff of life, earn your bread. And then, excuse me, oh, tell me where is fancy bread that rocks the bakers, it is said. Now, this must have been a current joke, because you may remember a Shakespeare line where it says, tell me where is fancy bread, where fantasy is originate, is being bred. And here they said, oh, tell me where is fancy bread that rocks the bakers, it is said. So that's one of these twists. By the way, the baker sells plain and fancy bread. So this is one of these things that again you can hardly translate. So now we have a long chapter. I can probably save my voice a little bit.
En route to his taciturn and, not to put too fine a point on it, not yet perfectly sober companion, Mr. Bloom, who at all events was in complete possession of his faculties, never more so, in fact disgustingly sober, spoke a word of caution, be the dangers of night town, women of ill fame, and swell mobsmen, which, barely permissible once in a while, though not as a habitual practice, was of the nature of a regular death trap for young fellows of his age, particularly if they had acquired drinking habits under the influence of liquor, unless you knew a little jujitsu for every contingency, as even the fellow on the broad of his back could administer a nasty kick if you didn't look out. Highly providential was the appearance on the scene of Corny Kelleher, when Stephen was blissfully unconscious that, but for the man in the gap turning up at the 11th hour, the finis might have been that he might have been a candidate for the accident ward, or, failing that, the Bridewell, and an appearance in the court next day before Mr. Tobias, or, he being the solicitor, rather old Wall, he meant to say, or Maloney, which simply spelt ruin for a chap when it got bruited about. The reason he mentioned the fact was that a lot of those policemen, whom he cordially disliked, were admittedly unscrupulous in the service of the Crown, and as Mr. Bloom put it, recalling a case or two in the A Division in Clanbrassil Street, prepared to swear a hole through a 10-gallon pot. Never on the spot when wanted, but in quiet parts of the city, Pembroke Road, for example, the guardians of the law were well in evidence. The obvious reason being, they were paid to protect the upper classes. Another thing he commented on was equipping soldiers with firearms or sidearms of any description, liable to go off at any time, which was tantamount to inciting them against civilians should by any chance they fall out over anything. You fritted away your time, he very sensibly maintained, and health, and also character, besides which the squander mania of the thing, fast women of the demimonde ran away with a lot of LSD into the bargain, and the greatest danger of all was who you got drunk with. Though, touching the much-vexed question of stimulants, he relished a glass of choice old wine in season as both nourishing and blood-making, and possessing Aperian virtues, notably a good Burgundy, which he was a staunch believer in, still never beyond a certain point where he invariably drew the line, as it simply led to trouble all round, to say nothing of your being at the tender mercy of others practically. Most of all, he commented adversely on the desertion of Stephen by all his pub-hunting confrères but one, a most glaring piece of ratting on the part of his brother medicos under all the circs.
All right, there's a lot of foreign words here. Hmm? To his taciturn, silent, and not to put too fine a point on it, that's, I think, a quotation from Dickens, not too fine a point on it, yet not yet perfectly sober companion, Mr. Bloom, who, at all events, was in complete possession of his faculties, never more so. In fact, disgustingly sober. As you know, Bloom hasn't drunk much since the Burgundy for the lunch. Spoke a word of caution, read the danger of night town, women of ill fame, and swell mobs, man, which fairly permissible once in a while. What is fairly permissible? I think we know what is meant, but it is not grammatically there. Not as have but what of a nature of a regular death trap for young fellows of his age, particularly if they had acquired drinking habits under the influence of liquor. Drinking habits, and if you're under the influence, you know, that liquor, unless you knew a little G22 for every contingency, as even a fellow on the broad of his back could administer a nasty kick if you didn't look out. So Bloom is advising Stephen. Highly providential was the appearance on the scene of Corny Kelleher when Stephen was blissfully unconscious. But for the man in the gap, the man in the gap who fights there and stops the army, turning up at the 11th hour, the Phoenix, and might have been that he might have been a candidate for the accident ward, or failing that, the Bridewell. He could either end up in hospital or being arrested in the Bridewell and then appearing in the court next day. That happens quite often in Norwood, that they do something funny, are arrested, and the next morning they have to pay a fine and then they can leave. Before Mr. Tobias, or he being the solicitor, rather old wall, he meant to say. So he's not quite sure about who is in charge, but as we all do. Or Maloney, which simply spelled ruin for a chap when you got worried about. So if you're arrested for a night, of course, it's not good for your reputation. There's a short mention of Maloney that we don't think much, but he was a very, very famous police officer who had found out, identified the murders of the Phoenix murder. So he was by that time, extremely famous person, which we can't know, of course, which simply spelled ruin for a chap they got worried about. The reason he mentioned the fact was that a lot of those policemen, whom he cordially disliked, were admitted as scrupulous in the service of the Crown. And, as Mr. Bloom put it, recalling a case or two in the A Division or in Combassion Street, prepared to swear a hole through a 10-gallon pot. That's, of course, nobody can swear a hole into a pot, but it's an idiom that is put in exaggeration. Never on the spot when wanted, but in the quiet part of the city, Pembroke Road, that is the good residences where the police is and the upper class people live, for example, the guardians alone were well in evidence. The obvious reason being they were paid to protect the upper classes. Another thing he commented on in this book, the chapter, you never quite know what Bloom is thinking and when he is speaking. And here you see, obviously, the next thing is said, and that he commented on was equipping soldiers with firearms or sidearms of any description, liable to go off at any time, which was tantamount to inserting them against civilians, should by any chance they fall out over anything. And then this is obviously direct speech, but direct speech is hard to recognize it. You frittered away your time, very sensibly maintained, and health, and also character, besides which, the squander mania, squander money, Stephen isn't careful about his money. The mania of squandering, the thing, fast woman of the demi-monde ran away with a lot of LSD. You could be robbed in the red light district into the bargain. And the greatest danger of all was who you got drunk with. Though, touching on the much vexed question of stimulants, he relished a glass of Joe's old wine in season as both Nelson and Blooming. He says, drinking is dangerous, but I myself, I believe in Burgundy and what we always know. And possessing a period virtues wine can have, notably a good Burgundy, which he was a staunch believer in, Burgundy. Still, never beyond a certain point where he invariably drew the line, as it simply led to trouble all round, to say nothing of, and that's a great phrase, to say nothing of, and then you say it. It makes us aware of many things we say that are really, really we not know the best noise. Do you know what I'm going to tell you? Say yes, and that's the end of it. Weißwurst? Mm-hmm. So we have these habits that are not really making sense. To say nothing of being at the tender mercy of, practically. Most of all, he commented adversely on the desertion of Stephen by all his pub-hunting confrères, but one, a most glaring piece of ratting the rats leave the ship, on the part of his brother medicos under all the circumstances. So Bloom observed that the others left Stephen and Lynch on his own. So you see the particular style.
One was Judas, said Stephen, who up to then had said nothing whatsoever of any kind. Discussing these and kindred topics, they made a beeline across the back of the custom house and passed under the loop line bridge, when a brazier of coke burning in front of a sentry box, or something like one, attracted their rather lagging footsteps. Stephen, of his own accord, stopped for no special reason to look at the heap of barren cobblestones, and by the light emanating from the brazier, he could just make out the darker figure of the corporation watchman inside the gloom of the sentry box. He began to remember that this had happened, or had been mentioned as having happened, before. But it cost him no small effort before he remembered that he recognized in the sentry a quondam friend of his father's, Gumley. To avoid a meeting, he drew nearer to the pillars of the railway bridge. Someone saluted you.
Stop here, then, yeah.
A figure of middle.
No, I'm going to stop here. Stephen was with Lynch, and Lynch went away. And so Stephen says, and that one was Judas, who betrayed Jesus. Stephen often compares himself to Jesus, said Stephen, who up to then had nothing whatsoever of any kind. So Stephen is rather silent, and Bloom does a lot. Bloom is very concerned about Stephen, and Stephen couldn't care less. By the way, who had said nothing whatsoever of any kind, you know that is wrong, because it said he expressed desire for a beverage, so he must have something said, but the chapter forgets it, so it's not reliable. And a lot, and this chapter, you could say, Joyce was somebody who didn't know how to write. It is full of awkwardnesses. There's probably not a single sentence in the description that is quite right, that you would pass as a teacher of English or schoolmaster. Discussing these and kindred topics, what does that mean, these and kindred topics? It's a rather vague way of saying they made a beeline across the back of the custom house. To make a beeline, you know that's going very straight. When you know that Stephen is drunk and shaky, as we heard, the word beeline may not be quite, it's a drunken bee, huh, that will make these steps. Across the back of the custom house and past on the loop line bridge, that's a railway bridge, when a brazier of coke, there's something, a brazier of coke, of a coke burning in front of a sentry box, there are stones, and the stones are watched by a guardsman, sent him off, or something like one, you see, but he's never quite sure of that, attracted their rather lagging footsteps. I don't know whether footsteps can be attracted. I think we perfectly understand. But by the way, this chapter is one of the most tricky to translate, because, as you can imagine, to get the right kind of wrongness so that it isn't attributed to the translator who didn't know his language is very, very hard. Stephen, of his own accord. Now, you don't have to say this, of his own accord. Usually people do everything on their own accord, unless they are specifically asked. Stopped, for no special reason, to look at the heap of barren cobblestones. And by the light emanating from the brazier, he could just make out the dark figure of the corporation watchman inside the gloom of the sentry box. So there's a sentry box and a heap of stones. He began to remember that this had happened, or had been mentioned as having happened before, and it was in fact happened in the seventh chapter. But it cost him no small effort before he remembered that he recognized in the sentry a quondam, that's Latin for some time ago, friend of his father, Gumley. And Gumley had been mentioned in the newspaper, actually. Gumley is minding the stones. To avoid a meeting, he drew nearer to the pillar of the railway bridge. So he wants to avoid it. And then Bloom says, "Someone saluted you." And then we go on to the next lot.
"Did you?" Mr. Bloom said. A figure of middle height on the prowl, evidently under the arches, saluted again, calling, "Night." Stephen, of course, started rather dizzily and stopped to return the compliment. Mr. Bloom, actuated by motives of inherent delicacy, inasmuch as he always believed in minding his own business, moved off, but nevertheless remained on the qui vive with just a shade of anxiety, though not funkyish in the least. Although unusual in the Dublin area, he knew that it was not by any means unknown for desperados, who had next to nothing to live on, to be about waylaying and generally terrorizing peaceable pedestrians by placing a pistol at their head in some secluded spot outside the city proper. Famished loiterers of the Thames Embankment category, they might be hanging about there, or simply marauders ready to decamp with whatever brutal they could in one fell swoop at a moment's notice, your money or your life, leaving you there to point a moral, gagged and garrotted.
No, stop here again then, no. So, there's an encounter. A figure of middle height on the prowl, again, dangerous, evidently, under the arches, saluted again, calling night. Stephen, of course, started rather dizzily and stopped to return the compliment. So, somebody Stephen knows. Mr. Bloom, actuated by motives of inherent delicacy, tactfully, inasmuch as he always believed in minding his own business, moved off, but nevertheless remained on the qui vive, on the alert, if something would happen again, like there's something dangerous, with just a shade of anxiety, though not funkyish in the least. Although unusual in the Dublin area, he knew, and he realized that this sentence is grammatically wrong. Although unusual in the Dublin area, he knew. He is not unusual. That's the kind of wrong kind of syntax, as you know. what happens is not unusual, but he knew that it was not by any means unknown for desperados who had next to nothing to live on, to be all about waylaying and generally terrorizing peaceful pedestrians by placing a pistol at their head in some secluded spot outside the city proper. Finished loiterers of the Thames Embankment, that brings you to London, where that category, they might be hanging about there or simply marauders, ready to decamp with whatever boodle they could. They could. Boodle would be what they say in Beute. They could, in one fell swoop. That is a thing, Shakespeare. You can kill somebody in one fell swoop at a moment's notice. Well, a fell swoop is always pretty quick, and mostly at a moment's notice. Your money or your life, leaving you there to point the moral, gagged, and garroted. So Bloom thinks what could happen. And as I said, the whole air is one of an adventure story. It's very dangerous to go. So.
Stephen, that is when the accosting figure came to close quarters, though he was not in any over-sober state himself, recognised Corley's breath, redolent of rotten corn juice. Lord John Corley, some called him, and his genealogy came about in this wise. He was the eldest son of Inspector Corley of the G Division, lately deceased, who had married a certain Catherine Brophy, the daughter of a Louth farmer. His grandfather, Patrick Michael Corley of New Ross, had married the widow of a publican there, whose maiden name had been Catherine, also Talbot. Rumour had it, though not proved, that she descended from the house of the Lords Talbot de Malahide, in whose mansion, really an unquestionably fine residence of his kind and well worth seeing, his mother or aunt or some relative had enjoyed the distinction of being in service in the wash kitchen. This, therefore, was the reason why the still comparatively young, though dissolute man, who now addressed Stephen, was spoken of by some with facetious proclivities as Lord John Corley.
Still go on, dear.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Now we go on.
Now we go on. Okay.
Stephen on one side. He had the customary doleful ditty to tell. Not as much as a farthing to purchase a night's lodging. His friends had all deserted him. Furthermore, he had a row with Lenehan and called him to Stephen a mean bloody swab with a sprinkling of other uncalled for expressions. He was out of a job and implored of Stephen to tell him where on God's earth he could get something, anything at all to do. No, it was the daughter of the mother in the wash kitchen that was foster sister to the heir of the house, or else they were connected through the mother in some way, both occurrences happening at the same time, if the whole thing wasn't a complete fabrication from start to finish. Anyhow, he was all in.
Yeah. Stephen, so Stephen knows somebody. When the accosting figure came to close quarters, again, to come to close quarters is reasonably a fight, but here just mean come close. Though he was not in any over-sober state himself, Stephen recognized Corley's breath, redolent of rotten corn juice. He had obviously been drinking something cheap. Now, we may know Corley. Corley is a figure in a Dublin story, Two Gallants, where Corley is going to out with a woman and get some money from her, and Lenehan is waiting behind. So we know him from there. We could know him. Reckon Corley's redolent of rotten corn juice. And now here you have, as in an epic, as in Homer, in fact, you have a character, and then you get the family connection of the person. This you get practically all the time in Homer, he was such and such. And this is here imitated. Lord John Corley, some called him. And his genealogy came down to this wise. You know, genealogy you get in Homer, or you get in the Bible, the genealogy. And now there's a long story how he was related. He was the eldest son of Inspector Corley of the G Division, lately deceased, who had married a certain Catherine Brophy, the daughter of a Louth farmer. His grandfather, Patrick Michael Corley of New Ross, had married the widow of a publican there whose maiden name had been Catherine also, Talbot. I'm sure you can follow this quite easily and repeat it. She's totally irrelevant. Rumour had it, though not proved. Rumour is never proved. If it's proved, it's not a rumour. That she descended from the house of the Lords Talbot de Malahide, we heard of them earlier on, in whose mansion, really unquestionably fine resident of its kind, and well worth seeing, like a travel brochure or something like that. His mother or aunt or some relative had enjoyed the distinction of being in service in the wash kitchen. So there's some connection to nobility, but it may be British. This, therefore, was a reason why the still comparatively young, though dissolute man, who now addressed Stephen, was spoken of by some with facetious proclivities as Lord John Corley. A long description. And now we see why we need the two paragraphs together. Taking Stephen on one side, he said, had the customary doleful ditty to tell, but he has no money. Not as much as a farthing to purchase a night's lodgings. His friends had all deserted him. Just as Stephen had been. Furthermore, he had a row with Lenehan and called it to Stephen a mean bloody swab with a sprinkling of other uncouth words. So Corley and Lenehan are no longer together. He was out of a job and implored of Stephen to tell him where on God's earth he could get something, anything at all to do. And then, no, it was the daughter of the mother. So whoever tells the story said, no, what I said before was wrong. I did correcting that dissent. No, it was the daughter of the mother in the wash kitchen that was forced to sit in the hair of the house. So it isn't quite right. You didn't get, or else they were connected through the mother in some way. Both occurrences happening at the same time. Well, if you're connected, it must be royals at the same time. If the whole thing wasn't a complete fabrication from start to finish, and you realize there was some relation, but I might get the relation wrong, and it doesn't matter anyway. That's almost Beckett, who often takes away things that has nothing. It's either this way or this way, and it doesn't matter because it must have been in some way. So start to finish. Anyhow, he was all in. And now we have the conversation.
I wouldn't ask you only, pursued he, on my solemn oath, and God knows I'm on the rocks. There'll be a job tomorrow or the next day, Stephen told them, in the boys' school at Dorky for a gentleman usher. Mr. Garrett Deasy, try it. You may mention my name. Ah, God, Corley replied. Sure, I couldn't teach in a school, man. I was never one of your bright ones, he added with a half laugh. Got stuck twice on the junior at the Christian Brothers. I've no place to sleep myself, Stephen informed him. Corley, at the first go-off, was inclined to suspect it was something to do with Stephen being fired out of his digs for bringing in a bloody tart off the street. There was a doss house in Mulberry Street, Mrs. Maloney's, but it was only a tanner touch and full of undesirables, but McConaughey told him he got a decent enough do in the Brazen Head over in Whitehaven Street, which was distantly suggestive to the person addressed to Friar Bacon for a bob. He was starving too, though he hadn't said a word about it. Though this sort of thing went on every other night, or very near it, still Stephen's feelings got the better of him in a sense, though he knew that Corley's brand new rigmarole on a par with the others was hardly deserving of much credence. However, hord ignaris malorum miseris succere disco, etc., as the Latin poet remarks. Especially as luck would have it, he got paid his screw after every middle of the month on the 16th, which was the date of the month, as a matter of fact, though a good bit of the wherewithal was demolished. But the cream of the joke was nothing would get it out of Corley's head that he was living in affluence and had nothing to do but hand out the needful. Whereas, he put his hand in a pocket anyhow, not with the idea of finding any food there, but thinking he might lend him anything up to a bob or so, in lieu so that he might endeavour at all events and get sufficient to eat. But the result was in the negative, for to his chagrin he found his cash missing. A few broken biscuits were all the result of his investigation. He tried his hardest to recollect for the moment whether he had lost, as well he might have, or left, because in that contingency it was not a pleasant lookout, very much the reverse, in fact. He was altogether too fagged out to institute a thorough search, though he tried to recollect about biscuits he dimly remembered. Who now exactly gave them, or where was, or did he buy? However, in another pocket he came across what he surmised in the dark were pennies, erroneously, however, as it turned out. Those are half crowns, man, Corley corrected him, and so in point of fact they turned out to be. Stephen lent him one of them.
Thanks. I'll stop here then, yeah. <I know. clears throat> So, I wouldn't ask you, Percy, on my solemn oath, and God knows I'm on the rocks. Stephen, there'll be a job tomorrow or the next day. I forgot. You know, it's now Friday. It's already tomorrow. Or the next day. So often in the small hours of the morning, you say today, and it's already the next day. But, Stephen told him in a boys' school near Darkey for a gentleman, usher, Mr. Garradisi, try it. You may mention my name. So Stephen says, you could be a school teacher, as he was, because he decided not to go back to the school. It's also quite nice if you have a temporary job and suddenly decide you don't go back to the school tomorrow, the next day. Oh, God, Corley replied, sure, I couldn't teach in the school, man. I was never one of the bright ones, he added with a half laugh. Got stuck twice in the junior at the Christian Brothers. So in the lowest class, you got stuck. And the Christian Brothers is the cheapest education you can get. I have no place to sleep myself, Stephen informed him. And of course, Stephen is far away from the tower and we don't know where he might sleep. Corley, at the first go off, was inclined to suspect it was something to do with Stephen being fired out of his digs for bringing in a bloody tart off the street that he... there was a Doss House, a sleeping place, a cheap place in Marlborough Street, where, by the way, you still get relatively cheap hotels, Mrs. Maloney's, but it was only a tanner touch, a tanner, 10 shillings, and four of undesirables. But McConaughey, whoever that is, told him you got a decent enough do in the Brazen Head over in Whitehaven Street. The Brazen Head is the oldest pub in Dublin. It is still open. I think they cleaned it 20 years ago or something like that. So it's a famous thing. Well worth seeing. And then, which was distantly suggestive to the person of Friar Bacon. What happens here, Brazen Head, there is a story of Friar Bacon and the Brazen Head. It's part of it. You could look it up. So Stephen instantly thinks of something literary, but that's merely the coincidence of a Brazen Head name also of a pub. He was starving too, though he hadn't said a word about it. Whoever has been in Dublin will be approached by somebody who has no money. And very often they have a wife and seven children and the wife is in the hospital and things like that. And when in two successive evenings, different people tell the same story. You know the story, but it's quite common. Though this sort of thing went on every night or very near it, every other night or very near it, always correcting it a bit. Still, Stephen's feeling got the better of him, in a sense. Though he knew that Corley's brand new rigmarole, on a par with others, was hardly to leave of much credence. One thing in this chapter here, I must say, is, I'll put it this way, those people who brought them into Homeric correspondences. And by that time, it's no longer quite true. For example, it is no longer Bloom who is the audition, but the figure that will turn up later. So it's no longer a one-to-one relationship. But what connects this to Homer much more is Odysseus came back to Ithaca disguised as a beggar. He has to find out who belongs to him. He has to say how he arrived. And he makes up all kinds of false stories. And Odysseus is very clever at knowing what people tell is not necessarily the truth. And he tells not the truth. So this is the kind of suspicion of what you can rely on, rumor, hearsay, whatever you tell. We know that now, of course, even now, that you cannot trust reports. Anyway, it's all heard of credence. However, and then you get some Latin, and that is from the Aeneas. It says, "I am not I'm not ignorant of the evil misery. I have learned to live with miserable circumstances," things like that. It's a quotation, and I'm not sure whether Bloom actually could have this quotation in mind. But it is. As the Latin poet remarks, especially as luck would have it, he got paid his crew after every middle of the month on the 16th, which was the date of the month, as a matter of fact. The date, as a matter of fact, is June the 17th, because it's the next day. Though a good bit of the wherewithal was demolished, because Stephen had spent money in the brothel, had invited the thing. And by the way, not to forget, though he spent a lot of money irresponsibly, it never occurred to him to give some money to his poor sister, who just got 1 shilling from her father. And we already heard of the poverty of the Dedalus family at home. So Stephen is not generous in general, but here he seems to be. And by the way, this is also true of Joyce, who was very good at borrowing money, but not quite so responsible at giving it back. But the cream of the joke was nothing could get out of Corley's head that he was living in affluence and had nothing to do but hand out the needful. Whereas, and many sentences are not complete. He put his hand in a pocket anyhow, not with the idea of finding any fruit there, but thinking he might lend him anything up to a bob, shilling or so, in lieu, so that he might endeavour at all events and get sufficient to eat. Not that people who beg for money because they're hungry always spend the money on food, by the way. But the result was in the negative, for, to his chagrin, he found his cash missing. You know, Bloom took it home. A few broken biscuits were all the results of his investigation. He tried his hardest to recollect for the moment whether he had lost, as well he might, or left, because in that contingency it was not a pleasant lookout, very much to reserve, in fact. He was altogether too fagged out to institute a thorough search. Though he tried to recollect about biscuits, he dimly remembered who now exactly gave them, or where was, or did he buy. However, in another pocket, he came across what he surmised in the dock of pennies, erroneously, however, as it turned out. Those are half crowns, 2.5 shillings, man Corley corrected him. And so, in point of fact, they turned out to be. Stephen lent him one of them. As I say, it is quite a bit of money. It was for 8 pence, about 1/3 of it. Bloom could have a meal, a lunch.
Corley answered, "Gentlemen, I'll pay you back sometime. Who's that with you? I saw him a few times in the Bleeding Horse in Camden Street with Boyle in the bill sticker. You might put in a good word for us to get me taken on there. I'd carry a sandwich board, only the girl in the office told me they're full up for the next 3 weeks, man. God, you have to book ahead, man. You think it was for the Carl Rosa? I don't give a shit anyway, so long as I get a job, even as a crossing sweeper." Subsequently, being not quite so down in the mouth after the 2 and 6 he got, he informed Stephen about a fellow by the name of Bags Comiskey that he said Stephen knew well out of Fulham's, the ship chandler's bookkeeper there, that used to be often round in Nagel's, back with O'Mara, and a little chap with a stutter the name of Ty. Anyhow, he was lagged the night before last and fined 10 bob for a drunken disorderly and refusing to go with the constable.
Good. Thanks, Corley answered. You're a gentleman.
In the morning, Mulligan said, Haynes thinks you're not a gentleman. You're a gentleman. I'll pay you back sometime. You can imagine how true this is, you know. I pay you back sometime. Who's that with you? I saw him a few times in the Bleeding Horse pub in Camden Street with Boyle and the bill sticker. You might put in a good word for us to get me taken there, because Boylan is an advertising person. I'd carry a sandwich board. Only the girl in the office told me they're full up for the next 3 weeks, man. God, you've to book ahead, man. So, Crawley said, who is this man, Bloom? I saw him a few times in the Bleeding Horse in Camden with Boyle and the bill sticker. Now, we know nothing of that. If Bloom and Boyle had met in a particular place, Bloom would be more involved on the whole thing. So if that is true, it gives a different perspective for the whole matter of the Belfast trip and Boylan. But it may not be true. It may be a mistake. And so this chapter is full of these kind of doubts. And we don't know. There's no way to know, as far as I know. And then Bill Sticker, you might put in a good word for us to get one taken there. Bloom could tell Boylan, and you know Bloom has been trying to avoid Boylan all the time to get me a job there. I'd carry a sandwich board. That is a low-paying job, as you can imagine. And we saw the sandwich men. Only the girl in the office told me they're full up for the next 3 weeks, man. God, you have to book ahead, man, for a mean job. You'd think it was the Carl Rosa. The Carl Rosa was a very famous opera company. I don't give a shite anywhere as long as I get the job, even as a crossing sweeper. Subsequently, being not quite so down in the mouth, after the 2 and 6 he got, he informed Stephen about a fellow by the name of Max Kaminsky that he said Stephen knew well out of Fulham, the ship chandler's bookkeeper that used to be often like Major's back with O'Mara and little chap of the sudden name of Ty. We never heard these names. They're not important. They're totally irrelevant. Some people who might help Stephen. Anyhow, he was lagged, that is, arrested the night before. I don't know who of them is, and fined 10 bob for a drunk and disorderly. It can happen that you're arrested for being drunk and you realize that Bloom helped Stephen at the end of the last chapter with the police so that Stephen was not put in jail till next morning for drunk and disorderly and refusing to go with a constable. Yeah.
Mr. Bloom, in the meanwhile, kept dodging about in the vicinity of the cobblestones near the brazier of coke in front of the Corporation Watchman's sentry box, who, evidently a glutton for work, it struck him, was having acquired 40 winks for all intents and purposes on his own private account while Dublin slept. He threw an odd eye at the same time now and then at Stephen's anything but immaculately attired interlocutor, as if he had seen that nobleman somewhere or other, though where he was not in a position to truthfully state, nor had he the remotest idea when. Being a level-headed individual who could give points to not a few in point of shrewd observation, he also remarked on his very dilapidated hat and slouchy wearing apparel generally, testifying to a chronic impecuniosity. Probably he was one of his hangers-on, but for the matter of that, it was merely a question of one preying on his next-door neighbour all round, in every deep, so to put it, a deeper depth, and for the matter of that, if the man of the street chanced to be in the dock himself, penal servitude, with or without the option of a fine, would be a very rara avis altogether. In any case, he had a consummate amount of cool assurance intercepting people at that hour of the night or morning. Good. Pretty thick, that was.
Mr. Bloom, in the meanwhile, kept dodging about in the neighborhood. Bloom is tactful. In the vicinity of the cobblestones near the brazier. that's a fire of coke in front of the corporation watchman sentry box, who, evidently a glutton for work, as it struck him, was having a quiet 40 winks for all intents and purposes. So what happens is, this man Crumley has a job, and his job is to watch a heap of stones. So we have a sentry box, and of course it isn't doing anything. It's a nice Irish occupation, you know. On his own private, while Dublin slept, he, Bloom, threw an odd eye at the same time now and then at Stevens, anything but immaculately attired interlocutor, as if he had seen that nobleman somewhere or other. So where he was not in the prison of truth for the state, nor had he the remotest idea when. Being a level-headed individual, that's also true of Odysseus, who could give points to not a few in point of shrewd observation. And again, you realize the awkwardness of the word point. He could give points to not a few in point of shrewd observation. So you always have, when you write, you should not use the same meaningful word too close together. On the other hand, you learn that you shouldn't repeat yourself too often. And that is also true, that you give a different name to the same thing. That was once called good style. He also remarked on his very dilapidated hat. We know what the dilapidated, but it's also because the dilapidated means one stone is taken from the other. There can be a dilapidated ruin, and the word, but the dilapidated hat is a bit strange. It's perfectly all right, but Joyce, I think, trains us to see the original meaning in the word hat and slouchy wearing apparel, generally, testifying to a chronic impecuniosity. You could say chronic impecuniosity in a shorter way, lack of money, but chronic impecuniosity is nice. Probably he was one of his hangers-on, but for the matter of that, it was merely a question of one preying on his next-door neighbor all round. In every deep, so to put it, a deeper depth. That must be the echo of a quotation, but I haven't been able to trace it. This chapter is full of such echoes, sometimes direct quotations. Remember, there was a rub, that was a rub, and sometimes just a vague echo. But it is full of, as I say, such reverberations. And for the matter of that, if the man in the street chance to be in the dock himself. You know, to be in the dock means you're accused in court. So the man is, he can be in the dock. But if you're in the dock, you're no longer the man in the street. Himself of penal servitude, with or without the option of a fine, you can be condemned to a piece in prison, or you could have to pay a fine. If the man in the street in the document said, it should say he would be, but would, the sentence isn't quite there, but would be a very rara avis altogether if in Latin for a rare bird. So you see, the language is touched up. One way of describing the chapter, and it's not easy, and I can't even do it, is this is the kind of writing that Bloom would attempt if he were able to do it, but he isn't. So it's a good example of not quite right writing that attempts to be literary and chatty and humorous and all of that. It's really a matter of not the best style. In fact, as I say, if you're a teacher of English, you would have to correct a lot, especially sometimes have a shorter expression. In any case, he had a consummate amount of cool assurance, intercepting people at that hour of the night, or morning, because it's already morning. Pretty thick, that was, certainly. And that pretty thick is more like ordinary thought and all of this. Yeah, we can just do a little bit more. Yeah.
The pair parted company, and Stephen rejoined Mr. Bloom, who, with his practiced eye, was not without perceiving that he had succumbed to the bland eloquence of the other parasite. Alluding to the encounter, he said laughingly, "Stephen, that is, he's down on his luck. He asked me to ask you to ask somebody named Boylan, a bill sticker, to give him a job as a sandwich man." At this intelligence, in which he seemingly evinced little interest, Mr. Bloom gazed abstractedly for the space of a half second or so in the direction of a bucket dredger rejoicing the far-famed name of Iblana, moored alongside Custom House Quay and quite possibly out of repair. Whereupon he observed evasively, "Everybody gets their own ration of luck, they say. Now you mention it, his face was familiar to me. But leaving that for the moment, how much did you part with?" he queried, "if I'm not too inquisitive."
The pair parted company, and Stephen rejoined Mr. Bloom, who, with his practised eye, was not without perceiving that he had succumbed to the blandiloquence of the other parasite. Alluding to the encounter, he said laughingly, "Stephen, that is, he's down on his luck. He asked me to ask you to ask somebody named Boylan, a bill sticker, to give him a job as a sandwich man." At this intelligence, meaning news here, intelligence, in which he seemingly evinced little interest. In fact, Bloom does not like to imagine the name or imagine Boylan at all, so it must be uncomfortable for him. Mr. Bloom gazed abstractedly for the space of half a second or so. Is vague anyone, in the direction of a budget dredger, rejoicing the far-famed name of Iblana, old name for Dublin, moored alongside Custom House Quay, and quite possibly out of repair. Whereupon he observed evasively, "Everybody gets their own ration of luck, they say. Now you mention it, his face was familiar to me, but having that for the moment, but leaving that for the moment, how much did you part with?" he queried. "Am I not too inquisitive?" And I go on now. "Half a crown," he responded. "I dare say he needs to sleep somewhere." "Needs?" Mr. Bloom ejaculated. And you see in this chapter, where the old style was, don't always vary things, don't say the same thing. And you know, in the book, otherwise, Joyce always said, he said. And here the words of speaking are changing, are manipulated. Mr. Bloom ejaculated. It's not what you mean. It's, of course, something comes out of your mouth very quickly. Ejaculated, but it's, of course, an odd word. Mm-hmm. Professing not the least surprise at the intelligence, "I can quite credit the assertion." So I can believe it, and I guarantee he invariably does. Yeah. "Everyone to his needs, and everyone according to his deeds." That combines the kind of communist thing, Marx, "everyone to his needs and to his deeds," and it also has a biblical background. "But talking about things in general, where," added he with a smile, "will you sleep yourself? Walking to Sandy Cove is out of the question. And even supposing you did, you won't get in afterwards across the rest of your station. Simply fag out there for nothing. I don't mean to presume and dedicate you in the slightest degree, but why did you leave your father's house?" Now, I read that now. I can quite. Then he added, "Walking to Sandy Cove is
Bloom has heard that Stephen is in Sandy Coast. And Sandy Cow would be quite a trek. I would guess it would take me, or would have taken me 30 years ago, about 3 hours. So it's a long way out of here. And even suppose you did, you won't get in after what occurred at Westland Station. Up at that Westland railway station, Morrigan and Haynes left Stephen and took the train south. And of course, even if he could go there, he couldn't get in because this is a big granite wall and you couldn't knock or anything like that. So Stephen, and here also we know that the first chapter is in Sandy Cove. Simply far out there for nothing. And then, and there always one, would Bloom actually say, I don't mean to presume to dictate here in the slightest degree. It's a bit overdone. What I mean here is, we cannot even be quite sure that what Bloom says in a different register from normalcy is what he actually says, or whether the chapter imposes this kind of talk on him. But why did you leave your father's house? That, of course, sounds like a biblical thing, but you mean family. To seek misfortune, was Stephen's answer. Yep. And then, I'll still go on. I met your respected father on a recent occasion. Bloom and Simon Dedalus were at the funeral and later on in the Ormond Hotel. Mr. Bloom diplomatically returned. Today, in fact, or to be strict, on yesterday, as I say, in the small hours of morning, you think it's today and it's already tomorrow. Where does he live at the present? I gathered in the course of conversation that he had moved. I believe he's in Dublin somewhere, Stephen answered. Why? Yeah, and I think, yeah, we stop here. That's quite a thing. Cameos is why. So we make a note here. Now, you've now seen, I don't know how you like this chapter. Some think it's very boring, and people like this. Other people, like myself, find this the funniest chapter of them all. And you get some familiarity, but you see how almost everything is off target. I mean, in a way, Joyce, whose book, after all, has just come into 100 years, and I wonder how you feel. You're reading that book now, 100 years ago, and the time is 1904, where women wore hats, there were horse-drawn carriages, horses in the street, and all of that. And yet it reads like today. It has that freshness. At least I feel that. I don't know whether you do, but otherwise we probably wouldn't read it. It still has something that is like yesterday. And this is a chapter that has its own charm, but it can also be like somebody who doesn't know how to write and tries to write. So I hope you have fun with this then. Till next week then. Goodbye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.